This is VOA News. I'm David Berg. Former U.S. Vice President Joe Biden has won five states, Virginia, North Carolina, Tennessee, Oklahoma, and Alabama, while Senator Bernie Sanders captured two states so far in some of the first results from the Democratic presidential nominating contests. Biden's victories, projected by cable television networks as the polls closed after his resounding win in South Carolina, came from support from African Americans, but he is also projected to win in Minnesota. Sanders, a self-declared Democratic Socialist, had been widely expected to take his small northeastern state, but he is also projected to win Colorado. Former New York Mayor Mike Bloomberg won the caucuses in American Samoa, but NBC is reporting that he will reassess his presidential campaign on Wednesday. In all, about one-third of the National Convention delegates are being picked on so-called Super Tuesday. The polls were open an extra hour in Tennessee after at least 25 people were killed by massive tornadoes that tore a path through the state early Tuesday morning. At least 18 of the deaths were in Putnam County, east of Nashville. Governor Bill Lee called it a sad day, but said help is pouring in from across the state and across the country.
I spent the day touring and visiting with victims and walking through neighborhoods, and the devastation is heartbreaking.
The tornadoes tore through areas of Nashville, destroying homes and businesses, uprooting trees, and plunging thousands into darkness with no power. President Donald Trump said that he would visit the area on Friday. The Federal Emergency Management Agency is already on the ground there. For more, visit our website. This is VOA News. Argentina reported its first coronavirus case Tuesday, while Spain announced its first death, as global health experts continued to grapple with how to control a virus about which little is known. Argentina's health minister says that country's first coronavirus victim is a 43-year-old man who spent 2 weeks in northern Italy, the epicenter of Europe's outbreak. South Korea reported another 516 cases, while mainland China reported 119 cases on Wednesday. South Korean President Moon Jae-in said that he would postpone a trip to the UAE, Egypt, and Turkey because of the virus crisis in his country. On Tuesday, World Health Organization Chief Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus urged people around the world to stop hoarding masks and other medical equipment because healthcare workers need them.
Shortages are leaving doctors, nurses, and other frontline health workers dangerously ill-equipped to care for COVID-19 patients.
Experts say surgical masks are no guaranteed protection against the virus, but they are essential equipment for doctors and nurses. Observers have noticed there's a gap between President Trump's comments about the coronavirus and the public comments from members of the White House task force. We get more from AP's Jackie Quinn.
Coronavirus. We're really working hard on it.
President Trump's public comments seem a bit rosier than those of the experts. Federal health officials are issuing solemn warnings about the coronavirus. Yes, it will spread. No, there isn't adequate testing just yet, although they're making progress on distributing test kits. And no, there is no vaccine, and there won't be one for probably about a year, says Dr. Anthony Fauci, who was showing President Trump the lab at the National Institutes of Health, comparing this to the SARS outbreak.
Phase one trial. Remember, that's not, doesn't mean you have a vaccine.
Right.
It means for safety. It was 20 months. Then H5N1 influenza, we got it down to 11.
Republican Senator Lamar Alexander has advice for the president. Let the non-political public health officials do the talking. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
Not even a Federal Reserve rate cut was able to help Wall Street on Tuesday, AP's Julie Walker reports.
The Dow sank 785 points to close at 25,917. It had surged 5% a day earlier on hopes for aid from the Fed and other central banks. In another sign of the market's caution, the yield on the 10-year Treasury sank below 1% for the first time in history. While the cut gave some investors exactly what they'd been asking for, the Fed says the ultimate solution will have to come from health experts, not central banks.
That's Julie Walker reporting. And I'm David Byrd, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, March the 4th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Togo's Constitutional Court confirmed the re-election of President Faure Gnassingbé.
We are very satisfied with the decision by the Constitutional Court confirming that Mr. Faure Gnassingbé continues to be our president, and we want to take the opportunity to express our sincere thanks to Togolese population.
Gilbert Bawara is Togo's Minister for Public Administration. A Liberian war crimes court campaigner says he was beaten and tortured on Tuesday by President Weah's security. Sudan's transitional government lifts restrictions on aid agencies. Meanwhile, the transitional government has been given reasons for firing over 100 diplomats earlier this week. And the UN cancels hundreds of human rights events over coronavirus concerns.
The Director General specified that that would entail cancelling all side events and encouraging representatives to refrain from travelling to Geneva for the rest of the session.
Kenya also cancels a parliamentary delegation to New York because of coronavirus concerns. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Togo's Constitutional Court confirmed Tuesday the re-election of President Faure Gnassingbé. The court confirmed the election commission results, which gave President Gnassingbé 70% of the total votes and 19% for main opposition candidate Abayomi Kojo. The opposition had rejected the results, saying they were made up. But Gilbert Bawara, Togo's Minister for Public Administration, says now President Gnassingbé can focus on the work of developing the country.
We are very satisfied that now the election period is over with the decision by the Constitutional Court confirming that Mr. Faure Gnassingbé continues to be our president. So we are very happy, and we want to take the opportunity to express our sincere thanks to Togolese population.
But the opposition still say that the results were fabricated. Did the court take their concerns into consideration?
You know, we had more than 9,389 voting bureaus, and the concern by Mr. Agbayome was related to not more than 10 voting bureaus. So you can see this is completely meaningless, and we hope he will stick to the decision by the Constitutional Court, and now we have to move with normal work developing Togo.
So, Gilbert, the U.S. Embassy in Lomé had asked for the Elections Commission to make public the results of each polling booth. Did that happen?
No. U.S. Embassy is not the president of Togo. I don't see Togolese population, the Togolese government, or the Togolese president, or the ambassador of Togo in the States asking the U.S. government to do things that have not been provided for by the rules of the laws. And maybe the embassy did not take time to read the Togolese electoral law. So this is not something serious that we can consider.
Gilbert, did your government put the Catholic Archbishop in Togo and opposition candidate Mr. Kojo, did you put them under house arrest?
No, not at all. I think the bishop you are referring to is completely free. Before the election, there was a number of religious leaders, including bishops, who take part in the political process. They expressed their support, and they were even with Mr. Agbayomi Kojo. So if Togolese express themselves against the will and the hope of some bishops, so this is democracy. So there's no need to put anyone under house arrest or to arrest anyone.
When do you expect President Faure Gnassingbé will form a new government? And should people expect that he will form an inclusive government?
Anyway, I don't have the power to express his behalf. I don't know whether he would like to form an all-inclusive government or not. But the only thing I can tell you is that his current mandate is valid until early May 2020. So between now and end of April, for him to swear in and then to form, if he so wish, a new government. So now we will return to work we need to make sure that the huge expectation by the Togolese population, their aspirations for development, for well-being, are met. So this is the most important for us now.
Gilbert, thank you very much. It's always nice to talk with you.
Thank you.
Gilbert Bawara is Togo's Minister for Public Administration. He was speaking with us from the capital, Lome. Kenyan members of parliament who were set to attend a meeting in New York City have been asked to return their allowances after their trip was cancelled due to coronavirus fears. Meanwhile, the National Assembly Health Committee has asked the Cabinet Secretaries for Health, Transport and Interior to appear before the committee for questioning about the Chinese airline that was cleared to land in Kenya despite the cancellation of airlines in and out of China. Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi.
Some of the Kenyan women leaders were scheduled to travel this coming weekend for the 64th session of the Commission on the Status of Women in New York City, United States of America. And while making announcements in Parliament yesterday, Tuesday, Kenya's National Assembly Speaker Justin Muturi cancelled the trip, saying the invitation to the conference was limited to countries with permanent mission at the United Nations headquarters in New York City.
I regret to inform the House that the scheduled travel by the representative of the National Assembly is hereby forthwith cancelled. Those members that were to travel would obviously know how to deal with the other issues related to facilitation, which may have landed in their accounts. You must therefore make good a complete and total refund. The House is accordingly guided.
This comes a day after the United Nations boss advised countries on Monday against sending their delegation to the event for fear of coronavirus. At the same time, Kenya's National Assembly Health Committee member James Nyikal has raised concerns over the Chinese airline that was cleared to land in Kenya despite the ban.
The Spanish flu of 1918 killed nearly 100 million people. One third of the world population at the time killed more people than the First World War. Schools had to be closed. Bodies were being collected from homes. That is the threat we are facing.
And I do not see how three cabinet ministers cannot come to attend this.
The committee chairperson, Senator Mbito Malinga, insists that the three cabinet secretaries, Fred Matiang'i of Interior, Mutahi Kagwe of Health, and James Macharia of Transport must appear before the committee today, Wednesday.
We are here to help Kenyans. If I'm to challenge the DG Immigration, were you the one who stamped and issued visas for those 239 passengers? Were you the one personally responsible for their entry to this country? I don't think you have an answer for that. If I go to the Minister of Transport fears, are you the one who issued personal clearance for that plane to land in this country and said it's okay? Is it you who made that decision personally? We want to find out from the CAS and the acting DG. This issue of self-quarantine, the 239 people, you sent them out to self-quarantine.
Kenya has also moved to suspend flights from North Italy, which usually has direct flights to the coastal region of Kenya, effective yesterday, Tuesday. According to the World Health Organization, the global death toll from the coronavirus epidemic exceeds 3,000, as more than 90,000 cases are reported. So far, the virus has spread to up to 60 countries globally after emerging in China late last year. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojiambo in Nairobi, Kenya.
The United Nations has cancelled hundreds of human rights events because of coronavirus concerns in accord with the Swiss government's decision to ban all public gatherings of more than 1,000 people. Lisa Schlein reports from the United Nations in Geneva.
In announcing the decision, the president of the UN Human Rights Council, Elisabeth Tichy Fieselberger, tells delegates she has received an urgent letter from the UN Director General in Geneva spelling out measures that have to be taken in light of the coronavirus situation.
The Director General specified that that would entail cancelling all side events and encouraging representatives to refrain from travelling to Geneva for the rest of the session. She also suggested that those special procedure mandate holders who are not already in Geneva could be encouraged to participate in the session via video conferencing.
Late last week, Swiss authorities took the unprecedented step of prohibiting large public events in response to a growing number of coronavirus cases. As a consequence, events such as the International Motor Show, which attracts a 500,000 people, and Swiss watch exhibits, which draw enthusiastic crowds of thousands of people, have been canceled. Human rights spokesman Rolando Gomez says 200 side events will be canceled until the end of this council session on March 20th. He says that is an unfortunate but responsible measure to take in order to prevent the coronavirus from spreading. He tells VOA the meetings generally attract on average 4,000 to 6,000 participants during the course of the session. He says those side events are very important.
I should point out, just as a technical note, they're not official council side events. They take place in parallel, and they're important as they inform the discussions in the formal proceedings. Of course, those lobbying efforts will continue unabated, which are important.
Side events are organized by non-governmental organizations and states. The Office of the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights also has spent a lot of time and effort in organizing several gatherings aimed at exploring particular aspects of human rights that demand a more comprehensive hearing and analysis. They will not be held. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Today's Wednesday, March 4th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Let's send a shout-out to listeners on all our VOA affiliate stations around Africa. Daybreak Africa time, 16 and a half minutes past the hour. Sudan's transitional government has removed laws, rules, and procedures that hamper the ability of humanitarian relief organizations to operate in the country. The move is being welcomed by relief agencies that say humanitarian aid access is needed to restore life to normal in the war-scarred Darfur region. Naba Muhideen has the details from Khartoum.
Sudanese authorities say that all obstacles that ousted government of Omar al-Bashir put in place to obstruct the work of humanitarian organizations and United Nations agencies have been removed. In a statement Friday, the head of Sudan's Humanitarian Aid Commission, Abbas Fadlullah, said Sudan has opened the door wide for the return of all international humanitarian organizations that were expelled during the era of the former regime. They include organizations like the World Food Program and the World Health Organization. Under the new rules, international aid agencies no longer have to get permissions from the General Intelligence Service, GIS, and military intelligence to operate in the country. Notifying the Humanitarian Aid Commission is sufficient. Authorities will also halt their inspections of aid agency operations. Ayman al-Badri, director of the UN Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization in Sudan, says he is happy to see the restrictions lifted. He says it's also important and a turning point, especially in observing and following up field work. He says organizations have funds from donors who want to see where the money is spent and who is benefiting it, and that can only be implemented through access to these locations. Previously, many organizations relied on Sudan's government reports or executive agencies, which had a lack of credibility. He says now there is a chance for more credibility. Aid agencies are especially eager to access Darfur, where the Bashir government fought rebel groups for years. At one time, more than 2 million people were displaced from their homes. 23-year-old Mawada Yagub lives in the Zamzam camp for displaced people. She says the return of aid agencies will make a difference. Mawada says getting non-governmental organizations back to work in Darfur is so important for internally displaced people like her, especially in the camp she lives in, where previously aid workers were harassed by the former regime and NGOs couldn't work well. Now if they come back, people will have the humanitarian aid needed. Officials say the decision is part of ongoing peace talks between the transitional government and rebel groups in South Sudan's capital, Juba. The sides are hoping to reach a final peace agreement to stabilize Sudan and allow the country to access international funding for the first time in years. Naba Muhideen for VUA News, Khartoum.
Sudan's transitional government this week fired more than 100 diplomats who were allegedly appointed without going through proper protocols during the Omar al-Bashir administration. The government says some of the ambassadors do not have the qualifications to be diplomats. Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
The fired high-ranking diplomats include 14 ambassadors at the Foreign Affairs Ministry appointed by the Assad President Omar al-Bashir. The government also let go 35 other ambassadors who were appointed to empower the Bashir's administration, according to the Sudan Sovereign Council. Taha Osman, a member of the committee tasked to dismantle the former National Congress Party, says the panel conducted a series of investigations at the Foreign Affairs Ministry and Sudanese embassies abroad and discovered that several diplomats were appointed for being close relatives of top officials in the ministry or for being loyal to the Bashir's administration. Speaking in Arabic, Osman says some diplomats exploited their position for self-gain.
There are immoral acts being done by some diplomats and ambassadors during the previous regime, which does not match with diplomatic ethics and does not represent the dignity of Sudanese people, and it has really destroyed our Sudanese diplomatic history.
Osman says some officials were appointed to their positions with direct instructions from Bashir, which is not proper procedure. Osman says the firings clears the way for appointing qualified diplomats from all different backgrounds who will serve their country honorably.
We wish that this decision would help build a new diplomacy for Sudan based on competency and qualification. And we wish that it would open a new door for transparent employment for all Sudanese, which reflects our diversity.
Khalid Musa, one of the Sudanese ambassadors who lost his job, says the firings are politically motivated.
Every diplomat and every ambassador is heavily invested on their career by the state and by themselves, and it is a human capital for the whole country, especially in this juncture of history, for their experience, for their expertise. And I think this is the right time to use them, not to damage their image.
Musa says the move to fire dozens of diplomats is illegal.
We are Sudanese citizens. All duties and rights are based on citizenship. We think that, you know, this committee doesn't have any right to deprive my citizenship right and to serve my country, and without any evidence.
In early January, the same Sudanese government committee dissolved dozens of institutions, including four media outlets, as part of the campaign to crack down on political activities of members who were appointed during Bashir's 30-year administration. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
A Liberian human rights campaigner says he was tortured by the presidential guard when he led hundreds of people to present a petition to President George Weah calling for the establishment of a war and economic crimes court in Liberia. Emmanuel Savis, leader of Liberians United for Justice and Accountability, accused the Executive Protective Service of arresting and torturing him near President Weah's offices. However, late Tuesday, President Weah's office released a statement accusing Savis and his group of breaching security near the president's offices. The statement says Savis and his group broke through the security and blocked vehicle entrances. The police later released all those arrested. Savis spoke with Moses Kaziewo.
You know, we went to petition the President of the Republic of Liberia. We got to the entrance. This is not my first time doing that. We always go, we see protocol, and it tells us what to do. And we told him that we're going to wait right there, and the President is going to come out to all, and we will petition him. They wanted three representatives to go and see the President, and we said, no, we want the President to come to us. And so I took the microphone to tell these guys to go back. By the time I make up my mind, I was off the ground. They took me into the president, to the security booth. They had me on the ground. They put something around my neck, my head, stepped my ears, kicked me in the head. And they made sure to put something around my head. And we did not block the president's entrance.
Did you receive major injuries?
Well, right now, as I speak to you, I think you saw me walking, my legs, my knee. Has been stepped on. I've been beating badly. My two ears, especially my left side, I'm not sure what they're putting around your neck to kick the hell out of you or stepped on you. You know, so I feel a lot of pain here. I want to make sure I'm not bleeding internally. I want to make sure that I'm okay, but I can tell you right now, and in as much as I still have to address this with the police, I'll be suing the government of the Republic of Liberia for what they did to me today.
What kind of petition were you opting to present to the president of Liberia?
We were presenting War and Economic Crimes Court petition. We want the establishment of War and Economic Crimes Court. I'm a member of LOJA, actually the executive director and funder. And we went to the national legislature and presented the very same document, and we want to make sure we present it to our president. Unfortunately, the president don't want that document, and so some of us were ordered beating, and that's how I end up in the hospital.
You were arrested alongside several others, as confirmed by the statement coming from the government through the Office of the Presidential Press Secretary.
I don't understand what you mean by several others. So there were five other people that were arrested. Can you imagine? We had a little under 2,000 people out there. And these people were with us. They are all being released. We got to be back at the police station at 10 a.m. tomorrow. They said they are forwarding us to court. And, you know, we're waiting to see what happened. We're confident that nothing is going to happen. We did nothing. In fact, we are the one who's supposed to be charging officers that work with the President of the Republic of Liberia. They won't be doing anything to us. We are confident that we have done nothing wrong.
Savvy, why you want this war crimes court established in Liberia?
Simple, 250,000 people died so that there will be no corruption. 250,000 people died so that we can have roads. 250,000 people died so we have medication in the hospital, so JFK can look better. 250,000 people died so we can have a better life. The truth is, 250,000 people died at the hands of those in power so that they can have power, and we have the worst Liberia for them to be able to afford everything they want. We have watched this trend, and, you know, as a man who grew up in this country and son of the soil, you know, I think it's incumbent upon somebody like me and others who think alike to do something about this. And someone may say this is going to stop me. No, I'm more fired up, and I'm going to still be back here for rallies, and we're still going to make sure that one economic crimes court conversation stay alive.
Emmanuel Savis is the leader of Liberians United for Justice and Accountability. He was speaking with Moses Gaziewu in the Liberian capital, Monrovia. Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of Africa news. Togo's Constitutional Court confirmed Tuesday the re-election of President Faure Gnassingbé. The court confirmed the election commission's results, which gave President Gnassingbé 70% of the total votes and 19% for main opposition candidate Abayomi Kojo. The opposition had rejected the results, saying they were made up. But Gilbert Bawara, Togo's Minister for Public Administration, says now President Gnassingbé can focus on the work of developing the country. Kenyan members of parliament who were set to attend a meeting in New York City have been asked to return their allowances after their trip was cancelled due to coronavirus fears. Meanwhile, the National Assembly Health Committee has asked the Cabinet Secretaries for Health, Transport and Interior to appear before the committee for questioning about the Chinese airline that was cleared to land in Kenya despite the cancellation of airlines in and out of China. Sudan's transitional government has removed laws, rules, and procedures that hamper the ability of humanitarian relief organizations to operate in the country. The move is being welcomed by relief agencies that say humanitarian aid access is needed to restore life to normal in the war-scarred Darfur region. And a Liberian human rights campaigner says he was tortured by the presidential guard when he led hundreds of people to present a petition to President George Weah calling for the establishment of a war and economic crimes court in Liberia. And that is it for this Wednesday, March 4th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
Hello, this is Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up. Like to stay on top of new music trends? breakout artists? New releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. Or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station, Saturdays and Sundays at 1500 and 2000 UTC.